Good morning.
Morning.
Are we on here?
Yep.
Well, yesterday we had a half-day session here in this room, and it went very nicely. I thought it was a great session. We had about 15 people, and a lot of them were new people. And I'm constantly inspired by the practice of those around me here at Zen Center. And it's one thing to do, to make a great effort and to do well if you've done a lot of sessions. Thanks, Will. Is it hot? A little extra caffeine. It's one thing to make a great effort if you've been doing sessions for a long time, but if it's your first one and you make a great effort and you're really present and you're very quiet and you do it with aplomb, I think that's really inspiring, because it takes a little leap of faith to come in here, I think. To just come to the center for the first time takes a little leap of faith, and to do a retreat, a traditional retreat where you really don't know what's going on and you sort of willingly put yourself in this situation where you're not sure about things, that can really help you to open up, but it's really difficult. So thanks to everyone who participated yesterday. So my wife Kathy and I were very fortunate recently. We got a real vacation. We went to Glacier National Park in mid-July. This was our five-year anniversary trip. And neither of us had ever been to Montana. And I've always kind of dreamed about Montana, because I think of it as this vast, empty space. And I grew up in a vast, empty space called North Dakota. And when I come to such spaces, it makes me happy. And I kind of long for that emptiness. Maybe that's what brought me to the emptiness early on. I don't know. But so I've always wanted to go to Montana. And also we heard, you know, that the glaciers in Glacier National Park are rapidly melting, and we wanted to see them before they're gone. And we heard, the most common estimate we heard is that by 2030, probably all of the glaciers in Glacier National Park will be gone, and that's only 17 years away. So I'm going to talk about the trip this morning, because it's going to help me to explore some things that I've been thinking about for quite a long time. Things having to do with each thing being important, each and everything being important. I've spent very little time in the mountains, so I kind of saw them with new eyes. I'm no expert on Glacier, for sure, and I'm sure there are people here who have been there who know it much better than I do. And my Dharma brother, Ben Connolly, has been going there his whole life, and in fact, he's there now, or maybe on his way back from there. He leads mindfulness trips in Glacier, where people all walk together through these beautiful natural areas, mostly in silence. And I think if you wanted to see Glacier, that would be the best way to do it. So before we went, Ben came over to our house, and he brought his big map, and he showed us a lot of good trails, and he gave us some good advice. Like he said, you should carry bear spray. And I'm like, really? I should carry bear spray? And he says, yeah. And you should practice your draw, because if you surprise a bear, you'll probably have about 20 seconds to spray him on the nose with the bear spray. So that's what I did. I went to a hardware store in Whitefish, and I got the bear spray, and I practiced my draw. And I was pretty worried, you know. I've never seen a bear in the wild, and they have grizzly bears there. And I was quite concerned. But then everybody was so kind of casual about bears and the rangers and everything. Like, oh, don't worry about the bears, you know, you'll be fine. And all these people were walking around without bear spray. So by the end of it, I kind of wanted to see a bear. I was really ready. I was really ready for a bear, but we never did see one, unfortunately. So we spent our first night in Whitefish, and then we got up early the next day, and we drove to the park. And we were going to a place called Logan Pass. So we entered the park on the west side, and the first thing we encountered was this line of vehicles about a mile long waiting to get into the park. So we sat there for about 45 minutes, and we got into the park. And then finally we got in, and we drove through this flat, kind of heavily forested area, past a big lake called Lake McDonald. And then we followed McDonald Creek for a ways, and we got to the point where that kind of began to climb into the mountains, or rather the creek was tumbling out of this gap between mountains. And then we seriously began to climb. We left the creek and got to a place where the road was cut into the side of the mountain. And this is called Going to the Sun Road, and it's the only road that crosses the park. And from this lake, Lake McDonald, up to Logan Pass, it climbs about 3,500 feet, which is well over a half mile. So that's quite a climb. And you climb a ways, and then there's just one switchback, and then you continue to climb for, I think, another 6 or 7 miles, and you just follow this one ridge all that distance, and it's cut right into the side of the mountain. So you're hugging the side of the mountain, and the views are really spectacular, and the road is really narrow. And you get up there, and you start encountering snow. You're driving past snow, even though this is middle of July. And then we got up to Logan Pass. That's at 6,646 feet. And the pass is right on the Continental Divide. It's way up there. And it's a spectacular place. You just can't really do it justice with words. It's a very high mountain pass, so you can see below you for such a great distance, and yet there are all these peaks towering above you as well. And you can tell that the air is thin. I didn't realize that right away, but about the second day, I could tell at higher elevations, my breathing was a little different from lower elevations, and I'd never really noticed that before. But it makes you feel really small, way up there in the mountains, you know. And I think there are probably a lot of reasons why monasteries tend to be located in the mountains in Tibet, in Japan. But I think one reason might be that when you're in the mountains, you're reminded of how small you are. You're reminded that it's not all about you. It's not, you're not the center of the world. And that's a good thing, I think, to be reminded of. So you feel pretty small, and yet Logan Pass is full of people. There's a parking lot up there, which can't be too big because there's not too much space in the pass, and it's a very popular spot, probably the most popular spot in the park. So we had to wait for a parking space. We had to wait for somebody to leave because we got there about 11 a.m. And the visitor center was full of people, and they were excited and kind of distracted, and some people weren't really watching where they were going, you know. I almost found them a little bit annoying, all these people. Shocking confession. But vacation is a little bit like Sesshin. It takes a while to settle down. It takes a while. So we hiked. We went on a hike every day, and that day we took our first hike on a place called Hidden Lake Trail, and it started at that visitor center. And it starts on a boardwalk, actually, and you're with a lot of people hiking out there. And then you get to the place where the boardwalk is covered by a snowfield, and you're hiking through snow for quite a long distance, although it's pretty warm. That was pretty nice. And the mountains are towering all above you. And after about a mile and a half, we came to a place called Hidden Lake Overlook, where you can look down at this lake, Hidden Lake, which is like this beautiful picture postcard kind of lake, a few hundred feet below you, beautiful blue in color and ringed by trees and in kind of a bowl. And most of the people stop at the overlook and then they turn around and they go back. But we kept going because we wanted to go down to the lake. So it was much less crowded now, and that was kind of nice. And there were some small areas of trees, but mostly it was kind of open country. And my eye was really drawn up to the peaks, of course, and also to these little snowfields. All over on these peaks, you know, peaks have crevices in them. And in these crevices were these snowfields, some of them triangular and some of them of a different shape. And at the base of each snowfield, or each snowfield of any significant size, there would be meltwater coming out, forming a little stream. So it might come down a little stream, and then it might form a little waterfall at some point, and then it would reform, and it would be a stream again. And it might go into the snow or under the snow, or it might go down toward Hidden Lake. And so there's a sound of falling water. Almost everywhere you go in Glacier, it seems, there's a sound of falling water. It's because of this meltwater. So we continued on. We saw some mountain goats. We saw quite a few mountain goats, and they're almost tame. They don't worry about people. There was, at one point, this mountain goat just wouldn't get out of the path, so we had to go around it. And they were shedding, and they have, so half of their bodies are really long hair and half are short hair, and they have these cute little horns, and they have this little smile. That was kind of fun. And we had a close encounter with a bighorn sheep, too. That was on the way back, actually. But, you know, bighorn sheep, those things are big. Those things are really large, almost as big as a cow. And they have these big, curly horns. And we were walking on the path, which is a path in the talus. Talus is broken up rock. So we've got this sort of slope of rock, and into it the trail is cut. And the trail's maybe a foot and a half or 2 feet wide. So we're walking through the talus, and we see this bighorn sheep walking right toward us. He's not on the path. He's 5 feet up above us, but he's just walking toward us. And he looks very stern, not cute like the mountain goats, really stern. And he just keeps coming. And it's like, you're on my mountain, Jack. That's what he's saying to us. And we realize he's not going to get out of the way. So we just step off the path, and we try to make ourselves look small. And I said to Kathy, don't look it in the eye, which is actually advice I had gotten about bears, but I think maybe it'll work on the bighorn sheep as well. So he just keeps walking by us, you know, and he doesn't look at us, and he looks very regal, and he's very much in his place, and he doesn't bother us at all. So that was that. And it was kind of cool, and these other hikers were watching, and they were kind of amazed. And Ben told us that was pretty unusual, that usually people don't come that close to those sheep. So I'm kind of setting the scene here. Still with me? So we're walking on the side of that mountain on this little slope. And then there's a series of switchbacks, and we drop down several hundred feet. And we enter this little forest that kind of rings the lake. And we go under some trees, and we're on the edge of this beautiful little lake. And we take off our backpacks and our hiking shoes, and we have some lunch, and we're feeling pretty good. It's our first day there. It's like, wow, we did it. We went on vacation. And feeling great. And this lake is about a half mile wide, and it's a couple miles long, but it kind of curls behind the mountain. So it looks like a round lake. It looks kind of like a bowl. So there are rock walls all around. So it's kind of like the cereal, the milk that's left in your bowl after you've eaten all of your cereal, kind of like that. And all around the ridge are these little waterfalls for this meltwater coming in, all around, kind of at regular intervals. And that's what creates the lake, those melting patches of snow. And it's funny, but I never really realized it works like that. You know, I like to think about how things work in the natural world, and I like to know that. And I knew that, you know, streams start way up in the mountains, but I always pictured rain falling up there and starting the streams. And I didn't realize that there are these heavy snowfalls all winter long, and then they melt all summer long, and that's where the streams begin. That's where it all starts, and you get this feeling that you're at the very top of the world. And in a sense, you are. And so we had a nice long rest, and we put our packs back on, and our shoes back on, and we walked along the shore. And the water of the lake was incredibly clear. You could see each individual rock on the bottom. You could see the bottom 20 feet out into the lake. And we came to this place where there was a stream that drains the lake, a small, clear stream, and it was maybe as wide as maybe about 20 feet or so and about a foot deep. So you have the calm waters of the lake, and then you have the place where the flowing begins there. And we were looking at in the water, and I saw something in there, and it was a trout. And then I saw there were a lot of trout right there where the flowing begins, and they were doing what trout do, which is to stay still in the water, basically. I think they move their little fins in such a way that they're still while the water is flowing. So it's kind of like being on a treadmill or something. And I found this really beautiful. The water was so clear that you could see all the details of the coloring of the fish, and there was a sound of the water and the coolness of it. It was cooler here down by the lake than it had been up above. We watched them for a long time, and I found these trout beautiful for another reason, and that is, you know, I've thought about trout before, I've even talked about trout before, and the way they hold themselves still in the stream, and to me it seems like a beautiful metaphor for our Zen practice, because the world is a very busy place rushing by us all the time, and in our Zen practice, sometimes, we can be calm in the midst of it, or we're just functioning in the midst of it, we're going with it, but there's something there, there's something kind of calm in the midst of this rushing world. No matter what happens in the world, we maintain our equilibrium. And it's the same as Manjushri up here right above me on the altar. He's an image of that too, because he's sitting on a lion, and yet he's perfectly calm. Image of what we do in Zazen. But I like the trout because it's a gentler image than the lion, I think. So that creek is called Hidden Creek, and it's 2 miles long, and it enters Avalanche Creek, which goes one more mile, and then it enters McDonald Creek, which eventually joins the middle fork of the Flathead River, which goes into Flathead Lake, and eventually finds its way to the Columbia River, and eventually it drains into the Pacific Ocean, because we were on the west side of Logan Pass. So now, all this geography has a point, so stick with me. On the east side of Logan Pass, there's the beginning of another creek. I think it's called Reynolds Creek. And it joins a river that actually turns north and goes to the Saskatchewan River and ends up in Hudson Bay. So Logan Pass is actually on the continental divide between the Pacific and the Arctic drainage basins. And a few miles south of Logan Pass is a place where the streams begin that eventually go into the Missouri River and then down to New Orleans. So this area really is a triple divide. And there's a peak called Triple Divide Peak, which is the beginning of all three of these watersheds. So there's this one point which all three of these watersheds have in common. And I looked this up in Wikipedia, and it says, most geographers, geologists, meteorologists, and oceanographers consider this point the hydrological apex of North America. Citation needed. So is that cool or what? I don't mean about the citation. I mean about the hydrological apex of North America. All of it starts here in these mountains with these tiny, tiny, clear streams of meltwater. And the trout are there at the very place where the motion begins. And the trout hold it all in place. You could say that. The whole system, the Columbia, Saskatchewan, and Missouri rivers, everyone downstream, all the people, all the animals, all depend on these trout. As long as they are there, keeping themselves motionless within the motion, everything holds together. Okay, well, that's what occurred to me. In a way, it's kind of my fantasy, you know. And you might even say it's nonsense. The trout could disappear, and the rivers would still be there, and we would still be here, and we probably wouldn't notice anything different. But in another sense, I think it's totally true that everything in these three watersheds depends on these trout. And I'm thinking of Huayan Buddhism. Some of you have studied Huayan Buddhism, which is something that developed in China maybe 1,400 years ago. And in Huayan Buddhism, there's a lot of discussion about parts and the whole. And a basic image in Huayan Buddhism is Indra's net, and that is an image of interdependence. And many of you have heard this. You picture a vast net, so made of rope or whatever, so you have all of these places where the rope comes together. And in each place where they come together, there's a jewel. And each jewel reflects on its surface all of the other jewels in the net. And that's an image of how everything fits together. And in his introduction to his book, Huayan Buddhism, Francis Cook says, that a whole is the result of the collaboration of many individual parts, each exerting its own causal power. A whole is the result of the collaboration of many individual parts, each exerting its own causal power. Thus, the part exerts total power in the formation of the whole. The trout is the cause of it all. And this got me thinking about a poem that I've been thinking about for years by William Carlos Williams, his poem, The Red Wheelbarrow, which many of you know, I'm sure. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. That's the whole poem. And I've always loved that poem. I love the vivid imagery. I think William Carlos Williams was really a Dharma guy because he could really see. His poems are so short, and it's just vivid imagery described with a minimum of words. And you know when he saw that, it wasn't he seeing it. He wasn't looking for something. It was just there. And by not looking, it appears to him, and he's able to convey to us what it means. He hasn't brought any of his own predispositions to looking. But I always wondered about this. So much depends. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. And so I'm thinking about this Wayan Buddhism thing. And I think it's something about how there is this vivid thing. There is this vivid thing. It's so vivid that it takes hold of us completely. Completely. And yet, it is still not to the exclusion of everything else. Everything else is just as vivid, just as real, just as important, and this vivid thing could not be without those other things. It's totally red, it's totally a wheelbarrow, totally glazed with water, and the chickens are totally white. And it's so in our face and so real, and yet so much depends upon them. They have no reality of their own. They are totally inseparable from everything else. Indra's net. So, in this way, the whole system is dependent on the trout. But it's not dependent only on the trout. And that's why dwelling on the trout is kind of my fantasy, because I want to pick out one thing and say, it's that. Well, it's everything equally. I like picking out the trout because it enables me to talk about this thing, and it's a beautiful image. But it's everything that's there that everything is dependent on. The melting snow above and the creeks below and the Columbia River and the barges that are heading down to New Orleans and the toxic waste in the river and the tourists and the bighorn sheep. We could focus on any one of these things. Each is the cause of everything there. And I have another poem, an excerpt from a poem by Gary Snyder, who wrote a book of poetry called Axe Handles, and there's a poem called River in the Valley, and part of it reads like this. From north of Sutter Buttes, we see snow on Mount Lawson and the clear arc of the Sierra south to the Desolation Peaks. One boy asks, where do rivers start? In threads in hills and gather down to here. But the river is all of it, everywhere. All flowing at once, all one place. So this is the Buddhist way of seeing, and it means that all things matter. It means that all things are important. You could say all things are sacred. Sacred's kind of a loaded word. We know that when Emperor Wu asked Bodhidharma, what is the most important principle of Buddhism, Bodhidharma replied, vast emptiness, nothing sacred. He was warning the emperor and warning us not to set anything apart from the world and say it's special, you know, not to put it on an altar. Not even the Buddha, not even the idea of Zen, none of that stuff can be set aside. Nothing is sacred. And that's important. That's an important warning. But you could just as well say that because nothing is apart from the world, every single thing is sacred. You could say that as well. So it's essential that we give every single thing its due that we respect every single thing, and that's central to our practice. And that's why it's so important how you place your shoes in the shoe rack. Do you do it with attention, or do you just drop them there? And it's so important how you come and sit down on your cushion. And it's so important that if you bow to your cushion, if you're in a formal setting, that you just bow your gift to your cushion, that you're not thinking about something else. That is so very important. That's all of your practice right there. There's no future time when your practice is going to pay off. That's it right there, just the bowing. And that's why making the tea is as important as anything else that gets done at Zen Center. That's why driving is practice. That's why my adverse reaction to all of those tourists is really, really important. I really need to look at that. I really need to spend some time with that. All of these things are Dharma gates. Everything is a Dharma gate. You can enter anywhere. So there's another way to come at the idea of each thing being important. And then there's a third way, which has nothing to do with ideas at all, and I'll get back to that later. But the other way to get to the idea of each thing being important is something we could call respect for the mystery. And there's something I read once. You know how sometimes you read some little thing and this light bulb goes on in your head and it like changes forever the way you look at things? This is one of those things. And it's from this odd little piece in this book. I read this years ago. I was reading a little book called Home Economics, written by Wendell Berry. Wendell Berry is, among other things, a poet. He's an environmental activist, and he's a farmer. And the book contains a short piece called Letter to Wes Jackson. Wes Jackson is the founder of the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, which works on developing ways to do sustainable agriculture in the Great Plains. And it's a wonderful place. So these two farmer activists are, one is writing to another, and he says, Dear Wes, I want to try to complete the thought about randomness that I was working on when we talked the other day. This gets a little dense, so please bear with me. So I was thinking about randomness the other day, and what started me off was this paragraph from a book called The Soil Resource by Hans Jenny. They're studying soils. And it says, raindrops that pass in random fashion through an imaginary plane above the forest canopy are intercepted by leaves and twigs and channeled into distinctive vert space patterns of through drip, crown drip, and stem flow. That's kind of poetic and kind of dense, but what it means is that rain falls in random patterns, and it comes into the forest, and then it's channeled by leaves and twigs and branches, and it is no longer random. It is now channelized. The soil surface, as receiver, transmits the rain message downward, but as the subsoils lack a power source to mold a flow design, the water tends to leave the ecosystem as it entered it in randomized fashion. So it's random, falling from the sky, it's channelized by the forest, and then it goes into the ground, and the ground does not channelize it, and it becomes random again. That's what that's about. And then my question, Wendell Berry says, is, does random describe a verifiable condition, or is it a limit of perception? My answer is, it describes a limit of perception. My answer is based on the belief that pattern is verifiable by limited information, whereas the information required to verify randomness is unlimited. To know something is truly random, we have to be able to stand outside the entire system. Otherwise, we can't know whether it's random or not. But as humans, we're not really able to stand outside of entire systems in that way. We can't really know whether it's random or not. We can't know whether there are patterns there that we can't see. If this is so, then Dr. Jenny should have said that rainwater moves from mystery through pattern back into mystery. we are all up against mystery. To call the unknown by its right name, mystery, is to suggest that we had better respect the possibility of a larger unseen pattern that can be damaged or destroyed, and with it, the smaller patterns. So if we think that just because we can't see a pattern, there is no pattern, we're going to make some big mistakes. We have to acknowledge our ignorance. We have to acknowledge our inability to see patterns because of our limited perspective as human beings. So we have to respect what we don't know. We can't be cavalier about a thing or destroy a thing simply because we can't see a significance to it. We have to be careful. We have to understand our own ignorance and respect that mystery. And he says, this has usually been left to religion. And I think it's true. Religion has this attitude of sacredness, and you leave it alone, and you just don't get too big, and you don't get too assertive. He also says that both the Greeks and the Hebrews told us to watch out for humans who assume that they make all the patterns. And, hubris, the idea of hubris. And he's suggesting that science, not just religion, can incorporate this respect for mystery, this respect for ignorance. So I think this is really cool. So it happens that our Buddhist respect for ignorance, of which we have a lot, not knowing is the basis of what we do, that also can be the path to our survival. Because if we don't know, we're not going to damage things. We don't understand. We cannot know what components of the natural world are essential for our survival. Maybe it is the snail darter. Remember the snail darter? Maybe it is the owl. What was the owl in the Northwest in that? There was a big hubbub of it. Was certainly kind of just spotted. Yeah, that owl. And I've heard the example many times that maybe some little species of plant in the Amazon goes extinct, and that could have been the plant that would have produced some wonderful medicine to save the human race or something like that. So we can't possibly know what effect things will have. We don't know what's going to happen when the glaciers melt. We can't possibly know what effect that's going to have. And now we have test tube meat. So respect for the mystery. I love that. And I said earlier that there's another aspect to this that doesn't involve ideas. And of course, that is the idea of our Zen practice, which does not involve thinking. Zen is not an intellectual exercise. Zen is not anything. This understanding that there is a mystery to be respected can be an intellectual understanding, but it could be much deeper than that. It can be sitting and being open to the next moment and actually entering into the mystery, actually living the mystery, and not even calling it mystery because you can't bring words to it. You can't bring a name to it. It's not a thing that can be accessed. It's just being open to the next thing. And it's entering into this thing right here with absolutely no expectation of where that might take us. Absolutely no knowledge of what that might be. This is what we do in our meditation. It's stepping back and seeing. When you truly see something, it's never what you expected it might be. It can't be. When a scene is before you, say you're looking at a grove of trees, or say you're looking at the things on your kitchen counter, and you look at it, and you want to know what's there, and maybe even you're trying to see it in the Zen way, if you're looking at it, you're going to inevitably focus on one thing and ask, well, what can that tell me? That's looking. But seeing is a different thing. Seeing is when you retreat from it, you let it be, you drop everything in your mind that tells you anything about that, and you just let it be. And it comes towards you. And it is never going to be what you expected. It cannot be. That is impossible. It can never be the thing that your conventional mind expected. And so we continually ask, what is it? And that means letting go of any idea we have about how things are. And we can think of that as being scary. And it can be a little scary. Zen practice can be a little scary. You go into the great unknown. You find out what you've been carrying around all these years. And there's some stuff in there that you're going to have to deal with, which is unpleasant. It can be difficult. But we can think of it as a great adventure as well. And so, to provide a little encouragement, I want to leave you with this statement from John Muir, which is on your program. Some of you picked up programs. And where I found this statement, Kathy found it, it's on the wall up high at that visitor center at Logan Pass. And she just loved it, and she took a picture of it. And and it says, few places in the world are more dangerous than home. Fear not, therefore, to try the mountain passes. They kill care, save you from deadly apathy, and call forth every faculty into vigorous, enthusiastic action. Nice sentence. So go to the mountains. Enter the mystery. But here's the thing. You don't have to go to the mountains to go to the mountains. You can come here, and you can sit on the cushion. 5:45 a.m. Monday through Thursday. Or if you're not such an early bird, you can come. We have a later sitting, and we have weekend sittings and things. But you can find it right here on this cushion. You don't have to go to the mountains. This is not enough. Going inside is the greatest adventure you can have, I think. So the river is all of it, and the top of the world is right here. So that's what I've got to say about my summer vacation. And thanks for listening. And we have a few minutes here. If anyone has anything to say, I'm certainly welcome to. Yes,
well. So, thank you for your awesome talk. I enjoyed this, and I love it when you talk about nature, like your North Dakota talk from a couple months ago. So I guess I have a comment question. I had a high school teacher who told us that you should always maintain your life. That quote, I'm wondering if you can talk about sort of the complementary nature or the balance between no big deal that you talked about yesterday, and then also that sort of magnificence of just the pot.
Yeah, no big deal Zen and big deal Zen. That's a phrase. I'm not sure who that phrase comes from. Is it Suzuki? Does anyone here know that phrase, big deal Zen? I certainly didn't make it up, but there's big deal Zen and no big deal Zen. And big deal Zen is when you make Zen a big deal. And you approach the altar, and you're going to bow, and you're thinking, this is it, I'm going to bring everything I've got here to this bow. And so, you know, you're a little stiff and awkward and strange about it. And you can bring that attitude to a sesshin as well. And I know, because I've done this many times, you think, this is my big chance. You know, I got time off from work. I've got 3 days here, and it's do or die. You know, I'm going to get enlightened or it's going to kill me. And so every moment, you're getting all militant about it, and you're making it a big deal, and you're building up this big thing. You know, you're building up this big thing in your mind, which is totally interfering with what sesshin is really all about, which is being present. And no big deal Zen is just doing the work. Just doing the work with no thought of reward. Just doing the thing. And that's where, in a long sesshin, most of us get there, because we get to this point where we kind of give up. We come with our militant attitude. We find it doesn't work, we give up, and we're, okay, I'll just do this stuff, you know. And then that's no big deal Zen. And when I talk about all things of being of equal importance, I mean, if we set aside these certain moments and say, well, the bow is the important thing and the sesshin is the important thing, then we're bringing stuff to that. Whereas if we say, no, opening the door is the important thing, and within the sesshin, each step of Oryoki, you know, it's the important thing. It's just this, just this, just this moment. Yes, Jeff.
Today and the previous 10 days have been the Fringe Festival in Minneapolis. And it's this marvelous performing arts festival with hundreds of different performances going on. And I saw several, but one in particular is one called Gray Matter. And it is a very interesting work by people from St. Paul City Ballet, basically. And it uses the words of René Descartes, his meditation on consciousness and self. And there's all this stuff about, you know, this is the one in which he uttered his famous dictum about, I think, therefore I am.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent time in the bread ovens after the bread had cooked, sitting there in meditation, trying to figure out all these things and trying to prove that he existed. So Descartes, I mean, you know, for me, is problematic in a lot of ways because he arrives at these conclusions that meditation, my own, and the Zen tradition, kind of upend.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, of course, that Descartes is very much a part of the Western philosophical tradition, very much a part of Western science, and Western science moves on. So I'm watching this performance, which was very, very high level. The moves of the dancers were precise. They were exact. They were very beautiful. And the words in the background were there. And so here is this group of people who collaborated together to put this piece together and perform it for us. And I was struck by the fact that, okay, according to this tradition, which Descartes is an important figure in, we now know that these bodies, all of our bodies, that actually something like 1 out of 10 cells in our bodies is a human cell, and the other 9 are actually bacterial. They're much smaller, of course, so they don't make up that much mass, but in terms of the genetic material, the genes that are going on and off, they're talking to each other and the rest of the body, you know, the self that Descartes was so concerned about, well, it includes a whole mess of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an eye-opening experience, that's all.
Yeah. Well, that was wonderful. I have nothing to add to that. Thanks, John. Anything else? Okay.